You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's a continuation of Nate Freeman Presents State of the Art with portraits by Jeff Henriksen. The Ringleader, Lucy Bull, age 35. Based in the bicoastal ideal, east side of Los Angeles, East Village of Manhattan. Gallery rep, David Kordansky. Elevator pitch, giant wonders of paintings that swell up with spore-like plumes. A heady psychedelic mix of surrealism and Helen Frankenthaler. Known associates, the Ion Pack, Rockers Chanel Beads, artist Elizabeth Englander. Big break. In 2019, she had shows at Hot Tastemakers on two continents, High Art in Paris, Smart Objects in Los Angeles, while also managing to curate a number of shows at the pint-sized venue called From the Desk of Lucy Bull. The venue was literally the surface in her studio she used as her desk. Sticker shock. The painting 1850 sold for $2.38 million. By the end of last year, she had surpassed $10 million in sales at auction. Fancy Pants collectors Andre Sakai, Liu Yikin, and Wang Wei. After Hours Vibe, El Prado, where one of her early works is permanently installed in the backyard smoking lounge. The Pacekeeper, Reggie Burroughs Hodges, age 60, gallery rep Karma, based in Bay Area, elevator pitch, haunting portraits on raw canvas or linen or wood washed first in black paint, infused with a musician's sense of rhythm. Known associates, writer Hilton Als, Dugan. Big break, painting has always been a very good friend to me. The break was becoming fully devoted to it. Fancy Pants collectors, Arnaud Eisenberg. After Hours Vibe, the one that's open. The War Painter, Mohamed Sami, age 41, based in London. Gallery reps, Luring Augustine, Modern Art. Elevator pitch, large-scale depictions of war by an Iraqi-born landscape master who watched Americans invade Baghdad in 2003 before fleeing to Sweden and could win the Turner Prize in December. Known associates, Shave. Big break, Ralph Rugoff included Sami in Painting Today, his star-making curatorial banger at the Hayward Gallery in 2021. The following year, Lonti Ebers donated a work to MoMA. Studio setup, East London. Sticker shock, $952,500 for the Praying Room at Sotheby's in November 2023. Fancy Pants collectors, Cheng Peno, the British government. The portrait painter, Amuaka Boafo, age 41, based in Accra, Ghana. Gallery reps, Marian Ibrahim Gagosian. Elevator pitch, Anio Scheel, who's also painting friends in Vienna, but most of his friends are Ghanaian hipsters from Accra's art and music scene. Known associates, Kim Jones. Writer Belinda Kazim Kaminsky, dealer Ibrahim. Big break, in 2019, Don and Mara Rubel gave him a residency at their Miami Museum, which is often a springboard to success for young artists. That happened quickly. A work that was purchased in June 2019 for $22,500 sold at Phillips months later for $880,971. Studio setup, a complex in South Accra that encompasses an artist residency and workshops. Sticker shock, a year after the astounding flip at Phillips, a result at Christie's in Hong Kong made that sum seem paltry. Hands Up from 2018 sold for $3.42 million. Fancy Pants collectors, Salome, Seattle art benefactors, Joseph Vaskovitz and Lisa Goodman, legendary Belgian collector, Walter Van Herentz. the systems artist, Li Haidi, age 28, based in London, gallery rep, pace, elevator pitch, abstractions filled with limbs and tree trunks made by the youngest person on Pace's roster. Big break. I feel like my big break is still to come. My work has been spreading in places like mainland China and Hong Kong, Los Angeles, and London, but I haven't shown in New York or across the rest of Europe yet. Sticker shock. In March, Drifted Petals on her lifted mound sold for $179,500 at Sotheby's, Hong Kong. Fancy Pants Collectors, Shah, Sandretto Ray Robodengo, Rashovsky. After Hours Vibe, honestly, I'm really bad at exploring London. I usually just end up going to Bistrotech in Hackney if I want something a bit fancy. Am I on TikTok? I'm not on the Western TikTok. I used to be addicted to Douyin, the OG Chinese version of TikTok. The GOAT. If we're talking about painting, then Pierre Bonnard is one of my favorites in history, and the artists who probably mean the most to me personally would be Francis Picabia and drawings by Hans Bellmer. The Humanist, Sanya Kantarovsky, age 43, based in New York, gallery rep Michael Werner, elevator pitch, a prophet of human emotion who works across medium and scale with works designed to break your heart. Known associates, his wife, Liz Magic Laser, Nicholas Party, Big Break. In 2018, the curator Elena Filipovic gave Kantarovsky a show at the Kunsthal Basel. Complete freedom to do whatever he wanted. Studio setup, Brooklyn. Sticker shock, his painting No Eyes sold at Phillips in 2021 for more than $500,000. Fancy Pants Collectors, Rashovsky, Salome, the I Know, the IYKYK Batshit Awesome Collection, the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, arguably the hottest collection of art ever assembled by a B school. The elder stateswoman, Amy Silman, age 70, based in New York, gallery rep, Gladstone, elevator pitch, process-based abstraction, awash with a floral palette, known associates, Rebecca Morris, R.H. Quaitman, Fong Hui, studio setup, her longtime studio in Brooklyn, and a newer house on the North Fork of Long Island, near where her immersive show is on view at Dia Brinchampton. Sticker shock, a painting called Junker One sold at Sotheby's, New York in 2023 for just under $1 million. Fancy Pants Collectors, My Louise Hessel, Charles Saatchi, Andy and Christine Hall. Secret Gift, one of the great artists who can also write her pants off. Faux Pas, her 2020 book of essays, is a staple in the studios of the city's young artist. The Tunneler, Lauren Quinn, age 33, based in Los Angeles. Gallery rep, pace. Elevator pitch, a taxonomy of funnels and swooshes across enormous canvases, a tilt-a-whirl through an Abex meets sci-fi landscape. Known associates, dealer Mickey Ming, Arne Glimker. Big break, the pandemic shutdown inadvertently was a huge break for me. I made so much progress in my work in that short time, I had nothing to lose. Sticker shock. $587,484 for a work on the block at Phillips in London in 2022. Fancy Pants Collectors, Jill and Peter Krause, Shaw, the Green Family in Dallas, the prolific Japanese collector Kankuro Oishima. Am I on TikTok? I can't use it. It ruins my sleep. I make an exception. I only allow myself to use it in airports, hospitals, and the DMV. Next photo, The Natural. Cy Gavin poses in Dutchess County, New York in August. The Storyteller, Maria Barrio, age 43, based in New York. Gallery reps, Hauser & Wirth, Victoria Miro. Elevator pitch, pastoral elegies with folkloric luminosity, surrealistic tales of displacement, painted by a Colombian based in New York. Big break, she won the first Joan Mitchell Fellowship Prize in 2021. The following year, a solo booth at Freeze LA nearly sold out ahead of the public opening, and in 2024, she joined Mega Gallery Hauser & Wirth. Sticker Shock, $1.603 million for her painting He Loves Me, He Loves Me Not at Phillips in New York. Fancy Pants Collectors, Olivia and Tom Walton, the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. The Shapeshifter, Emma McIntyre, age 35, based in Los Angeles. Gallery Reps, David Zwirner, Chateau Chateau. Elevator Pitch, a cosmic chance-based abstractionist with a palette of oxidized rust, watery paints, and other magical solutions. Known associates, Chateau Chateau co-founder Olivia Barrett, collector J. Patrick Collins. Big Break, earned a Fulbright to leave her native New Zealand and study at the famed Art Center in Pasadena, California, and the year she graduated was featured in a group show at Chateau Chateau. Sticker Shock, just over $200,000 for a painting that sold at Christie's in May. Secret Lunch, Spot, Hull Box, Inside Mercado La Paloma. The Goat, there is no single answer to this question, but a special mention for Pierre Bonnard, am I on TikTok? I am not. The Natural, Cy Gavin, age 40, based in upstate New York, Philadelphia. Gallery Rep, Gagosian, Elevator Pitch. If you thought landscapes of waterfalls and beaver lodges couldn't be sexy in 2025, think again. Known associates, curator David Breslin, Sergeant Als. Big Break, when the librarians at the Donora Public Library asked me to draw the facade of their new library when I was 11 years old. Studio set up, a dilapidated barn in northern Dutchess County, as well as a makeshift studio space in Philadelphia. Sticker Shock, $91,980 for an artwork at auction in 2021. Fancy Pants Collectors, Alicia Keys and Swizz Beatz, The Rubels, Lumpkin. The Beautiful Machine, Alvaro Barrington, age 42, based in London. Elevator Pitch, a painter with a protean source of energy, often making different bodies of work. Paintings on wood, charcoal, and acrylics on Japanese paper, mixed media on burlap paper, with several galleries on different coasts, often at the same time. Known associates, Thaddeus Ropak, Kohl's, Emelin founders Leopold Thun and Angelina Volk, along with several other major dealers. Big Break, Auntie Julie seeing me draw and buying me one of those How to Draw Anything books in 93. Studio set up, a sprawling complex in the Whitechapel neighborhood of East London. Fancy Pants Collectors, Low Art Collection, Bob Rennie, Poju and Anita Zabludowicz, After Hours Vibe, Yuki Bar. Am I on TikTok? No. The Goat, Tupac. Next photos, Neorealism, Hyperreal, Sasha Gordon's Whores in the Attic, 2024, LA artist Calvin Marcus, Yu Nishimura, Permeation, 2025, Fragmented Memories, Maria Barrio, Clotho, 2025, Hilary Pessis with one of her tabletop fantasies, Wyant's Here, My Dear, 2024, A Cinematic Canvas by Joseph Yeager, Sanctimony as a Pastime, 2022. Chinese painter Xinyi Jing in her Paris studio. Cheng's 2021 Smoked Turkey Leg. The Hyperreal Real Jill Melidi, age 45, based in Paris. Gallery Rep, Gladstone. Elevator Pitch, hyperreal paintings of the modern world with a flair of surrealistic touches. A wolf by the river or a dog in the playground. Purple-washed cityscapes. Known associates, curator Laura McLean Ferris, dealer Robbie Fitzpatrick, Gavin Brown. Big Break, the first time I was able to dedicate myself full-time to painting without the need to take on other jobs. That's when painting became the lens through which I would see life, shaping not just the work, but the way I perceive the world itself. Studio set up, a Paris abode with a very specific provenance. It was the childhood home of the writer and art critic Joris Karl Huysmans, author of the classic symbolist novel Erebor, which is believed to have inspired Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. Fancy Pants Collectors, The Rubels, Salome, La Consortium in Dijon. After Hours vibe, I love a classic Parisian bistro called Chez Georges on Rue de Mille. Am I on TikTok? I am not on TikTok. The GOAT, currently the artists who mean the most to me, are Goya, Munch, and Lautremont. Their work gets to the heart of what it means to be human, the cruelty and the beauty all together, the absurdity that exists in that contradiction. The Invisible Man, Justin Caguia, age 36, based in All We Have to Go On is USA, gallery reps, Green Naftali, Modern Art, elevator pitch, a grand swirl of lesnabis and manga and psychedelia by a mysterious artist who is said to carry the unstretched canvases rolled up in taxicabs. Big break. In 2017, he published a book of poems with the outfit Codette and had a performance at the Kunsthal Zurich. But he was mostly a cipher, said the writer Thomas Killian Roach. Even as a close friend, I know little about the particulars. Where he was, at what time, for how long, with whom, doing what. In 2018, he got a show at the Tastemaking Space 15 Orient. Studio set up. He once had a studio apartment in New York's Chinatown. It's not really clear where the guy is. Sticker shock. $1.09 million for The Saint Is Never Busy, a painting from 2019 that sold at Sotheby's in New York in 2024. Fancy Pants Collectors, the Blenheim Art Foundation, Cindy and Howard Reshofsky. The artist is not present. There appear to be no pictures of Kaguya on the internet. A feat. Next photos, the shapeshifter, Emma McIntyre, pictured in front of Pablo Picasso's bust of Silhouette, a giant sculpture installed in New York's Greenwich Village. The deadpan soldier, Calvin Marcus, age 37, based in Los Angeles, gallery rep Karma, elevator pitch and oeuvre of distinct unforgettable series, garish paintings of dead soldiers, linen shirts with screen-printed drawings of martini glasses, enormous paintings of sturgeon, lush fields of grass, absurdist fighter jets, known associates, fellow Angelino artists such as Jonas Wood, Tristan Unrau, Adam Alessi, Laura Owens, Thomas McDonald, Phil Davis. Big break. At age 26, he got his first New York solo show at Clearing, the Tastemaking Gallery in Bushwick, and turned up with a show called Green Calvin, 10 monochrome lime-colored canvases, each with a ceramic chicken carcass installed as a relief in the middle. It sold out. Studio set up, a former synagogue-turned-Baptist church in West Adams, Los Angeles, that he rebuilt and renovated over the course of years. After Hours vibe, my favorite restaurant in Los Angeles is Sushi Gin in Little Tokyo. Having a martini at Musso and Frank is always fun. Also, my friend Nick Fisher's bar El Prado was a good hang. Am I on TikTok? I am not on TikTok. Should I be? The GOAT. It changes for me. Maybe Warhol. I loved him when I was 16. I love him now. When you stand in front of a good Warhol painting, and most of them are good, you understand he's the best. Thank you. a modern Prometheus, from ushering in Citizens United to granting vast immunity powers, John Roberts paved the way for Donald Trump's destructive second term. By Christian Farias. Opening illustration by Andre Carrillo, which shows the judge at work in a mad scientist-looking lab. Forgotten in the arc of John Roberts's nearly two decades as Chief Justice of the United States is his role behind the scenes to herald the result in Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission. No, he didn't write the ruling that ushered in our current era of corporations and billionaires buying the presidency of the United States and other offices. But he can be credited with moving the chess pieces that made that sweeping landmark, authored by Justice Anthony Kennedy, possible. One version of the story finds Roberts so spooked by an unpublished dissenting opinion by outgoing Justice David Souter that the chief moved heaven and earth so that the document would never see the light of day. In it, Souter, a Republican and a big defender of campaign finance laws, called out Roberts for twisting the Supreme Court's own internal rules to arrive at a far-reaching outcome in an otherwise small-bore dispute. In this case, a decree that the First Amendment places no limits on so-called independent corporate and union expenditures in our elections. That's not the legal question the Supreme Court had been asked to decide. And so other versions of this palace intrigue find Souter pleading with Roberts and the rest of the court to not overrule prior precedents curbing the influence of money in politics, and to rehear the case so that those precedents could get a second look and a fresh round of briefing and argument. Souter got his parting gift. On the final day before the Supreme Court broke for its summer break in June 2009, Roberts announced that the case would be re-argued at a later hearing. Immediately thereafter, as his last order of business that day, the chief also announced with sadness that this is the last session in which our friend and colleague Justice David Souter will be on the bench with us. Problem solved. By the next January, Citizens United would become the law of the land. This is but one data point for how Roberts, more than any other politician in the United States, has set the stage for Donald Trump's disruptive second presidency, one far more destructive than the first, and yet distinct in kind from any other in modern history in that the president truly feels unbound. And in advancing an extreme vision of presidential authority, he's no longer ruling over Washington and the nation as a lone head of state. Instead, the executive power, which Article II of the Constitution vests in one president of the United States, has been freely shared with billionaire and mega-millionaire ruling partners, Elon Musk chief among them. Trump's cabinet, the wealthiest in history, at least holds legitimacy in that its members, like Linda McMahon and Howard Lutnick, were approved by the Senate, as the founding document instructs. Not so Musk, the Tesla and SpaceX chief, who donated $250 million to Trump's reelection effort and over time has received tens of billions in government contracts from a multitude of agencies, has operated in a constitutional vacuum, largely unconstrained by law or rules of ethics. As the leader of the inaptly named Department of Government Efficiency, which is neither a congressionally approved department nor efficient by established metrics, Musk was allowed to wield a breathtaking level of authority over the executive departments and other agencies he's beholden to, above and beyond that of the cabinet itself. Much of this unchecked lawlessness is water under the bridge by now, as judges, save some exceptions, have been too slow to stop the bleeding or police abuses, whether that be funding cuts Congress never approved or shocks to the federal workforce. sensing early on how this unholy alliance of money and power flew in the face of rules Roberts and his court have erected for officers of the United States, as spelled out in the constitutional text, a group of Democratic attorneys general cried foul in federal court. Although our constitutional system was designed to prevent the abuses of an 18th century monarch, the instruments of unchecked power are no less dangerous in the hands of a 21st century tech baron. One can only wonder what Roberts thinks of a duly elected chief executive and an unelected de facto prime minister leading the charge on mass firings across federal agencies, dismantling decades-old departments, and impounding appropriations that by definition are already the law. Roberts' own branch of government is not exempt from DOJ's intrusions. Judges, law clerks, and court employees have all been put on high alert over the Trump administration's documented encroachment, even on day-to-day court operations. These breaches of the separation of powers, both real and imagined, and the anti-constitutional monster spreading its tentacles across Washington would have horrified the founders. But that's yet another consequence of unlimited wealth corrupting our politics. Democracy gives way to an oligarchy that, in turn, may buy you a quasi-monarchy with few guardrails. Roberts and the other justices responsible for Citizens United may well believe that independent expenditures do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption, as they insisted at the time. The Trump-Musk reign of chaos has put that idea, fanciful then and now, to rest. This corrupt bargain should haunt Roberts in other ways. During the presidential transition, as if anticipating the legal resistance to the incoming Trump administration, the chief saw the future when he dedicated his year-end report on the federal judiciary to the threats to their independence judges face day to day. The report, which doesn't mention Trump by name, is nonetheless replete with not-so-veiled allusions to what the president and his supporters have visited upon judges since he took office, including threats of violence, intimidation, and disinformation about what individual court rulings mean or require. These dangerous suggestions, however sporadic, he wrote, must be soundly rejected. Defiance, which has been a theme of the past few months, hasn't abated. And that's because one element Roberts didn't foresee was that Trump wouldn't be the only one with pitchforks out against judges. Musk, other administration officials, and far-right figures who have grown in influence on X and in the president's circle have also joined this high-tech lynching, to borrow from Clarence Thomas. When an incensed Stephen Miller grossly misrepresented a Supreme Court ruling that urged the Trump administration to facilitate the release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland man who had been unlawfully sent back to a prison in his native El Salvador, that only set the stage for more defiance by the White House. In that case, as in other politically charged cases, Trump has been on the losing side in the courts, and the more he loses, the fiercer his and his supporters' attacks on judges get. Indeed, a Reuters investigation in May found that John J. McConnell Jr. and James Boasberg, chief judges of their respective federal courts in Rhode Island and the District of Columbia, are top of the list among federal judges whose families have faced threats of violence or harassment after they ruled against the new Trump administration. Roberts has tried to turn down the heat to little effect. For more than two centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreements concerning a judicial decision. Roberts wrote in a statement in March, as Boasberg phobia reached a fever pitch, "The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose." The attacks didn't relent. At a portrait unveiling in May for John D. Bates, a George W. Bush appointee, and yet another veteran judge MAGA has viciously targeted for ruling against Trump, Roberts could be seen sitting next to Boasberg and other members of the judiciary in Washington, lending his presence and offering pleasantries in a room full of judges at a moment many of them feel under siege. As it happens, many of these same judges collectively presided over more than 1,000 prosecutions related to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Then, as now, they've had to contend with an emboldened right-wing fever swamp led by the President of the United States that cast the rioters as political prisoners. The nation has Roberts to thank in part for this attempt to rewrite the history of the assault on our democracy. The chief led the way not only in granting Trump broad immunity over his actions and inactions on that day, he also shielded him from the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment by blocking a bid by Colorado voters to bar him from the ballot. Had Roberts not maneuvered to defang that centerpiece of the post-Civil War amendments in this latter case, Trump might have been ousted from public life for good. In the face of all this aiding and abetting, Roberts' gestures and public comments in defense of judges come across as woefully insufficient. Worse, they mask his hand in paving the way for Trump's worst excesses in just about every area of law and policy that matters to his administration. Fresh on the public's mind is the Supreme Court's indefensible immunity decision, which effectively shut down a criminal trial accusing Trump of masterminding his disruption of the transfer of power. Roberts' florid language in that ruling makes it plain that he believes the president deserves special treatment as the head of one branch of government, beyond the reach of the casual cruelty that everyone else faces in the criminal system. Yet the longer-term import of Trump v. United States, as longtime scholars of executive power have observed, may be how the Trump administration is embracing it today. In Trump's hands, the ruling isn't just a shield from prosecution. It's a weapon to decimate the federal workforce, to dismantle agencies Republicans and business interests have long disliked, and to fire independent watchdogs and regulators Congress has seen fit to protect from White House interference. Indeed, the idea that Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president authority over every corner of the executive branch has long been a Roberts hobby horse, and the Trump administration is riding it everywhere it goes. When Trump unlawfully fired National Labor Relations Board member Gwen Wilcox, the first time in the history of the Labor Board that had happened, the Justice Department relied on the immunity decision and others by Roberts to justify the dismissal. The president's firing authority is untouchable by Congress, D. John Sauer, the Solicitor General, told the Supreme Court in a legal brief. And so the chief went right along, and acting on his own, quickly allowed Wilcox's firing to proceed. More than a month later, without bothering to hear oral arguments, his majority ignored nearly a century of precedent and gave Trump complete control over the NLRB's leadership. Today's order, Justice Elena Kagan wrote in dissent, favors the president over our precedent. Carried to its logical end, Roberts' jurisprudence bolstering an all-powerful and energetic president to do as he pleases spares no one. Not the beloved Librarian of Congress, fired. Not the transformative Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, fighting for its life. And certainly not the unlawfully renditioned migrants disappeared to a notorious El Salvador prison, still disappeared. In all these instances, the Trump administration can point to a constitutional ruling by Roberts for justification. Even the Trump-led purge of a government that is diverse, equitable, and inclusive, or part of its all-out war against Harvard University, can be traced back to Roberts' blinkered thinking on race. Eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. And that was a quote. Trump's Washington is Roberts' Washington, and the greatest beat of the Supreme Court that bears their names may yet be the wholesale destruction of government as we know it. In one executive order that garnered little attention, Trump directed his agencies on a review and repeal rampage to get rid of rules of governance that have long been on the books. The source for this directive? 10 cherry-picked decisions, all but one of them issued by Roberts' majority or supermajority, covering everything from affirmative action policies to environmental law to religion and public life, that the administration thinks should carry the day. It's too early to tell where this slash-and-burn campaign will end up. But if nearly 20 years of Roberts have taught us anything, it is that once he rules, the nation is left to figure out how to fix what he has broken, if it can be fixed at all. Now here's the Proust Questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis, Allison Janney, the Oscar winner on Dog Names, Drowsy Therapist, and her jam band aspirations. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Dance music, incredible food, great friends, and lots of dogs. What is your greatest fear? Being boring. I have had two therapists fall asleep on me. Not kidding. Are people even reading this far? Which living person do you most admire? My niece, Petra Janney, who got her pilot's license to rescue animals from rural kill shelters and have them placed with different pet adoption agencies. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Oh, I have a long list. You should ask me what I like about myself. That list is much shorter. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People who punch down. What is your greatest extravagance? Postmates. What is your favorite journey? Coming home after being away for a chunk of time. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Self-control. I would rather not elaborate. On what occasion do you lie? Always to spare someone's feelings, especially my own. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I would love it if I was just a few inches taller. That is a joke. Which living person do you most despise? Three guesses. And the first two don't count. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I say, I don't know, a lot. Which drives me crazy. What is your greatest regret? Not throwing more caution to the wind. Which talent would you most like to have? I have this fantasy that I'm playing lead guitar in a band that in some obscure bar, and I'm killing it. What is your current state of mind? Politically apprehensive, yet personally cautiously optimistic. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I wish I always had the right word and the right moment at the right time, and not 2 hours later in my car going home. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Having a career in this crazy business. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'd want to come back as a better version of myself, if that is even possible, ha ha ha. What is your most treasured possessions? The photographs my uncle Michael Putnam took of my family. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Wanting something for someone you love more than they want it for themselves. I lost my brother to addiction. Where would you like to live? London, maybe Hampstead Heath. What is your favorite occupation? Well, before I could call myself a working actress, when asked what I did, I would say I was a photographer. I still think that is a cool occupation. What is your most marked characteristic? My voice. What do you most value in your friends? A sense of humor, honesty, and trust. Who are your heroes in real life? Firemen, philanthropists, and first responders. What are your favorite names? I spend a lot of time thinking up dog names. Currently, I love Ocho, Paco, and Gary. What is it that you most dislike? Dishonesty, controlling people, anchovies. How would you like to die? I do not like to think about that, but I could tell you how I would not like to die. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Allison Janney. Now we'll have another Proust questionnaire with illustration by Ryan McAmis. Josh Brolin, the actor on Dry Skin, The American Dream, and the famous Brolin Behind. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being with my wife and my kids in Italy, in a small village on a side street, with laundry hanging from building to building above us, and from some random window, the sounds of a teenager practicing arias from Puccini's Turandot. What do you dislike most about your appearance? All the Brolins have the bums of small mountains. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Bitchin' and sesquipedalism, and I can't even pronounce it, listener, sorry. When and where were you happiest? Every time I've been able to witness one of my children being born. Which talent would you most like to have? Virtuoso violinist. What is the trait you most deplore in others? A lack of humility. What is it that you most dislike? Dandruff. What is your favorite journey? Anything that stokes the fire inside me, from dilapidated motels to a resort in the middle of a Middle Eastern desert to an Airbnb in the highlands of Scotland. Experience, learn, repeat until the end. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? I don't consider any virtue overrated. On what occasion do you lie? When someone else will get hurt if I don't? Which living person do you most despise? Anybody who is actively trying to shift a democracy into a void of a constitution, plutocracy. What is your greatest fear? Something awful happening to our children. What is your greatest regret? The time I wasted trying to prove I was somebody. Which living person do you most admire? Oprah, Anthony Zerbe, Michelle Obama. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? My need to overprotect. I have scenarios zoetroping through my mind that I wish weren't so paranoid. What is your favorite occupation? Linguist. What is your most marked characteristic? My level of care. What is your current state of mind? Curious about how to go further. How to stop looking at the painting and start swimming in the painting. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My malleability. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'd come back in a past era as a foreigner to experience what it felt like to want to become an American and pursue the American dream. What is your most treasured possession? My first edition, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by James Agee, signed by Hunter S. Thompson. James Agee, and every piece of art my children have made for me. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? The pursuit of power at any cost. What do you most value in your friends? Emotional bravery. What is your motto? Why not now? Who are your favorite writers? Melville, Didion, Gogol, Steinbeck, Rilke, James, Norman Mailer, Ursa Daly Ward, and Daniel Cross. What is your favorite hero of fiction? Santiago from The Alchemist and Stephen Dedalus from Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Who are your heroes in real life? Anybody with the bravery to be themselves. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Josh Brolin. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.